Well, when we read about the history of the world, we do live in the age of information now, where it's not just the Encyclopedia Britannica that the middle-class families have on the bookshelf, but, well, even children, teenagers, can just put their hand in the pocket, pull out the phone. Google seems to know just about everything. Although I did see a T-shirt once that said, I don't need Google because my wife does know everything, but nonetheless... I shouldn't have said that, should I? I'll probably be in trouble later. Anyway, we live in the age of information, and what we can know about science and history and current affairs and everything is quite phenomenal with these smartphones, whether you're Apple or Samsung or whatever it is. But how would you summarize it? That's my point, really, my opening point. How would you summarize the history of the world? However many thousands of years. No, it's at least 8, 10. Some would think a lot longer. I would think the Bible would be pointing us towards a young earth, but whatever that. What summarizes the history of the world? If I had given you paper or had made sure there was pens on all of your chairs here this morning and asked you to write on the back of your news sheet, I would imagine some would write sin. Sin has characterized the world. But if you would remove sin and a biblical worldview, and would just look at the world as unbelievers do, your neighbors, your friends and everybody, should look at the world through the eyes of an unbeliever, what characterizes, what fills our history books? Surely there may be one or two things, but war would be very high, if not top of the list. They say there has never been world peace. There has always been, maybe not a huge nuclear war or a world war, but there has always been a tribe somewhere fighting, killing another tribe nearby. There has never been on the face of the earth a time where all war ceases. Even on Christmas Day. During World War I, you can read the history of it. I believe that they came out of the trenches. There was a truce. They played football together. They exchanged gifts, had a drink, went back to the trenches, and then went back to killing each other as of Boxing Day. But even then, there were tribes somewhere in Africa and in Asia killing and fighting one another. You read the history of continents, of nations, of empires, of tribes, and it is characterized by war, killing, assassinations, coups, and the like. We're studying together from the Bible the book of Genesis, and we know that right from the very beginning, as soon as you get into chapter 3, you've had the account, the narrative of creation itself, which nobody can know but God, because he was the only one that was there after all. He narrates us, reveals to us, pleased to reveal to us in those two chapters how and in what order he made all things. But as soon as we got to chapter 3, we saw that there was this serpent who was making war ultimately against God through Eve and Adam. And there is friction, there is tension, isn't there? And it might not be he's biting or trying to strangle and kill Adam and Eve, but he is tempting them into spiritual death, isn't he? And there is friction and fighting. It might not be all out a beast ravaging a human being, but there's certainly war, isn't there? There's war between the serpent and the living God. There is then war between Adam and God. Adam rebels against God and is saying, I will not have you ruling and reigning absolutely over me. I will make my own decisions no matter the consequences. Once that has been done, it is said very clearly in chapter 3 that Eve and Adam will war one with another. As soon as we're outside of the garden in chapter 4, Cain is killing his brother Abel. And then as soon as you carry on turning the pages, as we have been doing, there are these various families, tribes, and nations that are warring with one another. Even in just 14 chapters of the first book of the Bible, we can see that men are at war with other men. Husbands and wives are at war one with another often. Communities are at war with each other. And most importantly, man is at war with God. Ancient, modern, national, international, wherever it is, inwardly, in the family, in the home, and everywhere else, mankind and the history of mankind is dominated by war. Now, I didn't phone up our friend Donald Trump and ask him to bomb Iran in the next couple of weeks because we were talking about this. It just seems to turn out that providentially, we've had a war, a short one, admittedly, right in our national news in the last few days. The human heart is characterized, isn't it, and dominated by strife and violence and hatred. And you look at all the monuments and the pictures, and you only need to type into Google and you get all kinds of quotes, won't you, from Winston Churchill and presidents of the United States and everything else, where some of the best speeches, most rehearsed and repeated speeches, have been on the border of war, during war, or in the aftermath of war. Military history from the book of Genesis here and on to our modern day is an absolutely fascinating subject, and somewhat close to my home is a lot of my family were military men. My father was in the Navy for quite a number of years. Looks like I'm going to have a helper. Hello there. How are you this morning? Hey. Hey. Do you want to come and get her, or are you just going to leave her, or? Fair enough. Is this going to be a weekly event or a one-off? Looks like weekly. We'll have to get used to it then. Hey. Well, I got a microphone and I got a job to do and the clock's ticking against me, so I'm going to get on with it. Well, here we are. Like I was saying, grandparents, both my grandparents in the war. Many of you will remember, won't you? You'll remember the rationing and other things. Here in the passage we're looking at now, invasion, capture, under tribute, rebellion against these things, 4 kings against 5, we are told. Every village in the area would have been plundered. The countryside would have been laid waste, if I can get it out. The population virtually wiped out, led into captivity. The area would have seemed, the historians tell us, as an abandoned cemetery, even for centuries. And in the midst of this tumultuous, turbulent, violent, brutal activity, there is Abraham, the man of God, Lot, his nephew, but spoken of as his brother, significant, because Abraham must be his brother's keeper, unlike Cain with Abel. Abraham gathers his trained men and pursues the victors in a daring rescue mission. He successfully recovers Lot, his family and possessions, all the captives and possessions of the others, and he is offered great reward, but refuses to take what he feels the Lord has not given to him. Oi! Come on then, you. You're going back to mum. Right, we got 3 points, 3 headings. Got to focus, haven't we? Real history that confirms the Bible's accuracy. Real history that confirms the Bible's accuracy. We need to look at that just briefly. Real violence. The second one is a real violent passage. We're used to it, aren't we? Oh, we hear about bombs being dropped. We hear about assassinations. We hear about mass shootings in America now, don't we? 30 years ago or so. Shock, horror. Now, the numbers, they don't even mean anything anymore. Whether it's single figures, double figures, or triple figures, they don't mean anything now because we've become so accustomed to the violence that is in the world today. Real violence, though, that challenges the pacifists amongst us, maybe. And then real war that causes the believer to depend upon God. 3 points for us this morning. Maybe the first one, more for unbelievers, but an encouragement to us as believers. This is real history. Real history. You've got the historians, whether it's in America at Yale or Harvard or Oxford and Cambridge and Durham and various other places, and there they are with all the letters after their name. They've written all the books, and they're the absolute experts. People like me and you, well, I won't say all of you, but some of you maybe, we're looked down upon as a dummy. What do we know about world? What do we know about ancient history? Most of these people, we've never found a tablet, we have never found a monument, we've never found any evidence whatsoever that half, if not most, of these people, places, and events exist. And it's fairy tales. You're talking into ancient history that you've got no ability. There's no credibility to be talking about these things whatsoever. Until very recently. Scholars now, the educated, go to the university, you can go to these places, these conferences, the world-renowned historians, the scholars, have now confirmed the immense and precise accuracy of the history that we are reading here. And if not, dare I say it, the entire history of these books in Genesis, and then you've got books like Joshua and the Kings, and then you've got in your New Testament the book of Acts, haven't you, with literally thousands of people, very technical titles and names, objects, events, comments on political things that aren't recorded, as far as we know, until relatively recently, anywhere. But they keep finding these caves. They keep finding these tombs. They keep finding these scrolls and these monuments as they go through the Middle East with a fine tooth comb. Between 1974 and 1976, I would like to say a few years before I was born, but just afterwards, 20,000 tablets were discovered. I can't pronounce this, Tel Markadiki or something like that. It's in Syria, the site of ancient Ebla that we're reading about here. And these tablets contained the names of Jehovah, Abraham, Esau, David, Saul, Michael, Israel, places like Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, Bela, Zoar, and others. And these scholars, well, we could caricature them with their bow ties and tweed suits and maybe a moustache and well-kept hair and probably smoking a pipe or whatever it was in the 50s and the 60s, were scoffing and laughing at us. But now, got to eat their words, didn't they? Looking at real history. That confirms the unimaginable, immense and precise accuracy of the Bible on hundreds of ancient names, places, customs, laws, events, and everything else. What does that do for me? It just confirms me. I know that the Bible is the Word of God because Jesus has spoken to me. I know categorically. I'm not waiting on ancient manuscripts. I'm not waiting on archaeology. I'm not waiting for science or whatever to catch up with the Bible or anything else. I don't need those things. I know inwardly and spiritually that Jesus is alive, risen from the dead, and I can trust the Bible on who Jesus is, what Jesus has done, and his resurrection. But unbelievers here this morning, or if you've got doubts and fears, or if you've just become a believer, if you are struggling, do these things not help you in some way? An unbeliever, they should challenge you that there is no book like this book on all the face of the earth. And there will be multiple people who are willing to give their lives, and millions who have given their lives, opening this book Sunday by Sunday, explaining to us who God is, what we are, why the world is as it is, and the way of salvation. And if you could even find a jot or a tittle that you could prove categorically is a contradiction and false, and you could find any science, any archaeology, if you could come up with a watertight argument to prove anything in the Bible is false, the whole thing is nonsense, isn't it? But like we have been going through the Middle East with a fine-tooth comb, looking down in caves, looking down in Egypt and all over the place, and we're finding monument after monument, scroll after scroll, that the scholars are looking at going, oh my goodness, yeah, that does prove the Bible to be true there, doesn't it? Oh, that one proves that event to be true as well, doesn't it? Oh, this person that we doubted ever existed, who's mentioned a number of times in the Bible, did actually exist, didn't it? And on it goes, so that in the age of information and the 21st century in which you and I live in, it would be, well, would it not be easy to prove that a book that was written thousands of years ago by a bunch of ignorant liars is false? But it's not. And over and over and over and overwhelmingly in the universities and the scholars and in the museums and the archaeologists and the historians, they're just going, we can't find anything wrong with it. Jesus said of his words that heaven and earth is going to pass away, but my words will never pass away. There are things that I have said over and over again outside of this pulpit that I regret saying. And there are certainly things that I've said here on Sunday that I wish I'd have said differently. I've never had to retract anything that I've said, thankfully. I may have wanted to rephrase it, say it in a different spirit, say it more graciously and lovingly, rephrase it maybe. But every single one of us has said things that we regret. Every single one of us have said things that are false. Every single one of us has actively deceived another person for a various reason. But the Bible, you can go through it with a fine-tooth comb. You could find all the scholars in the world and you could times that by 10,000 and give them all of eternity. And they will never find anything wrong with the Bible. It's a challenge. Because you can go through any history book. You can go through any religious book. You can go through any website. You can go through any. And you will find something wrong with it. But here we have a book that's written by over 40 different people. In three different languages. On three continents. Over thousands of years. All different people, ranging from educated presidents and priests and civil servants, all the way down to ignorant, illiterate shepherds who had to get a scribe to record it all on thousands of different subjects with hundreds and thousands of names and customs and laws and technicalities and historical events and social comments on this, that, and the other that even the greatest scholars all over the face of the earth are thousands of years behind, maybe, and it will take them years and years and years to catch up with the history of what is going on in the Bible. Real history, my friends, that confirms the Bible's accuracy. I may not be able to pronounce all of their names properly and all of the places properly, but archaeology has caught up in our own generation, my lifetime anyway, to confirm that all of these men did exist, and all of these places did exist, and all of these events really did happen. It's why many, many, many men, women, and children, faithful followers of Christ and servants of Christ, have been giving up and willing to give up time, money, reputation, comfort, freedom, even to be imprisoned, tortured, and give up their lives at a young age for the Bible, because they've come to realize that whatever the Bible is speaking about, whether it's history, whether it's Jesus Christ, whether it's the gospel, whether it's your soul, whether it's heaven or hell, whether it's God, whatever subject it touches, it can be absolutely trusted. Inerrant, infallible, inspired, perfect, powerful, sufficient. And as Jesus teaches us to build our lives upon a rock, what he's saying is to build our lives upon what he says and what has been said about him leading up to his coming. It's no wonder that people like little Mary was willing to walk for days and days and days and then to weep bitterly when she'd walked from Wales to London, I think it was, to buy a Bible from the Bible Society and to be told that there were none left. Well, it's not surprising, is it, that people are willing to fill suitcases and travel through rivers and various things to cross borders into areas to get Bibles to people that would love to read them. And it should challenge and encourage us to love the Bible, to read the Bible, and most importantly, to believe the Christ of the Bible. Real history that confirms the Bible's accuracy is in front of us. Second point is real violence that challenges the peacemakers or the pacifists, maybe. This is real war. Women were made widows, children were left as orphans, and women and children would have been cut down and murdered in a most brutal way, and other things that are not fitting to be spoken about in the assembly of God's people. This is a major invasion that we're not looking at. I wouldn't want to call the thing in Iran a little squabble. People have died, but this is not a petty squabble that went on for a couple of days. It's a major, major invasion. It's a problem, isn't it, for the peacemakers and the pacifists, maybe, who love to say, blessed are the peacemakers. Some have condemned all acts of war and then saying there's no such thing as just war, that there shouldn't ever be any violence, we shouldn't spank our children in any way, shape or form. Surely you should be able to reason with them and there shouldn't be any kind of punishment whatsoever. And you know what? If we're going to lose our country and our possessions, our home and our families and lives, we would rather lose them than bear arms. And well, if the sovereignty of God would cause us to lose absolutely everything and die a miserable, painful death, we would rather that than take up arms. But that's not what we see all the way through Scripture. It's not that I don't appreciate gentleness. I see some of the women, some of the older women are so gentle. It said as a child they couldn't say boo to a goose. It's a gentleness, a quietness, a compassion about them, and we certainly can see something of the essence, something of the nature, some of the characteristics of Christ, who did say to us, if somebody, an individual, slaps you on the right cheek, show them the left. It's more blessed to give than it is to receive, is some of the teaching of Jesus. To love God is the first commandment, but to love your neighbor as you love yourself, and even to love your enemies and to not retaliate to your enemies, is the teaching of the Bible. When it comes to international events, national events, Abraham did fight. And he had 318 men that he had trained in self-defense and war, we are told. And he is very quick to tell us in verse 19 and 20, particularly at the end of verse 20, because he's speaking about God, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. God had got involved. It's not that God is going, I can't even look upon this. I can't even look upon this. This murdering, this butchering, this fighting. Can't even look. I'm turning away. This grieves me so desperately. I can't even look. No, God looked and gave the victory to Abraham. Abraham was no fatalist who sat back and said, you know what? It's not for me to intercede. I am safe by the grace and the goodness of God. It's lost disobedience in going down there anyway, and this is God's judgment against him. Why make enemies with all of these other kings who could possibly kill us in the future, maybe, and endanger the promises of God? He didn't turn round like Cain and say of Abel, am I my brother's keeper? Yes. One moment it's telling us that it's his nephew, his brother's son, but then the next minute it's telling us that he is his brother and he sees himself as his brother's keeper. And why shouldn't he? Why should not we protect the innocent from unjust brutality? Jesus was a man of peace, a gentleman, a bruised reed he will not break, and a smoking flax he will not put out. He is mindful that we are but dust, and when we are at our weakest, when we begin to shed tears maybe, when we are sorrowed and grieved, depressed, discouraged, and this, that, and everything else, Jesus is a tender, compassionate, merciful, kind sympathetic best friend to the weak and to the needy. But he's more than that. And we see him in the temple, don't we, turning over tables. And it's highly unlikely that no one or no animal was hurt in the ordeal. If you think that Christianity is just this placid, passive, pacifistic, no violence whatsoever, no war, no fight, no getting your hands dirty, no, nothing like that whatsoever, and you're just going to, well, come away from the world and be in absolute peace and joy before you get into heaven, you need to remember that Jesus turned over tables. And to think that no human being and no animal got hurt in the whole affair, I think, is pretty naive. But as all of the Bible points us to Jesus, and particularly to the cross, does this not point us there? That because the world is as it is, God himself was willing to, I almost want to say, get his hands dirty. God himself was willing to give his cheek to have his beard pulled out. God himself was willing to give his back to be scourged, wasn't he? God himself was willing to give his face to be spat upon. And you could say, well, there he is, the ultimate pacifist who is just giving himself into the hands of violent men. But when you get to the heart of the cross, that's what the communion table is all about, isn't it? That's what the Bible is all about, getting to the heart of the cross. Seeing through the visible. Yes, we look at the scourging. Yes, we look at the enemies. Yes, we look at his friends. Yes, we look at Mary. Yes, we look at all the events that are going on. Yes, we look at the physical part of it, the crown of thorns and the nails and everything else. But we look into the invisible part of what is going on at the cross. The book of Isaiah tells us that it pleased the Lord to bruise him. The book of Zechariah tells us that God says prophetically, awake, O my sword, against my fellow, the one who is my equal. That it pleased God, who is a God of peace, a God of love, to punish his son himself in the place of others. That's what the word propitiation means, isn't it? That he is propitiating the just wrath and anger of God against sin. You can't gloss over these passages and say, oh, that's dirty, oh, that's violent, oh, there's killing, oh, I don't even want to think about the rape and the other things that were going on in all of these passages. Let's just move on quickly. We live in a dirty world, a violent world, a cruel world. A world where men kill other men. And God is not this God who's just sitting there shaking, saying, I don't like these things whatsoever. A God who in just judgment punished his son in the place of others. And you can't look at Jesus and go, he's the ultimate pacifist. Because you read the book of Revelation and he comes back, doesn't he, riding on a white horse to make war against his enemies. And it's not just spiritual enemies. It's not just the devil and the fallen angels that are caught up in this campaign of vengeance and righteous indignation. But it is all those who will not bow to him, who will not serve him, who will not fight for and with him, who caught up as his enemies. And it's blood-curdling language. The story, I think I've told it before, even relatively recently, that somebody went to an evangelical preacher who believed the Bible, and when it says things like it's outer darkness where the worm will never die, there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And they looked and they said, do you think it will be that bad? And the evangelical preacher turned around and says, no. And there was a smirk upon the face of the young Christian or the person who was reading the Bible for the first time, whoever they might have been. And then he turned round as he took a breath and said, it will be unimaginably worse. You do not want to end up the enemy of God. Of all things you do not want to be the enemy of God. You could maybe say, I wouldn't want to be the enemy of Mike Tyson in a ring. I wouldn't want to be the enemy of Muhammad Ali, for those who are older, maybe. You wouldn't want to fight this, that, and the other person. You certainly wouldn't want to carry a knife around late at night in Ipswich with the gangs and this, that, and the other, possibly. But of all of these things, why would you want to remain an enemy of God outside of Jesus Christ? His holy wrath and justice and his righteous indignation against his enemies at the end of time is blood-curdling stuff that should drive you to a cross where God the Father punished his Son in the place of others. Real history that confirms the Bible's accuracy, and real violence that would challenge the pacifist and remind us that it is only in heaven where there will be peace. There has been war all the way through the Old Testament. God has even sent his people into war for certain just reasons. There was punishment and blood and death at the cross. And there will be real violence at the end of time. This is the world in which we live in. And so it reminds us and moves us as we close this morning that there is real war that would cause us to depend upon the Lord. It was a great plan, and we don't have all of the details like we do with something with Joshua and Gideon and others who are hugely outnumbered. It's a great plan, and he'd obviously trained his men well. There were 318 of them, we're told. They attacked at night, a brilliant commander of trained men. Outnumbered but victorious. Recovered all of the goods, all of them, so there weren't any buried and hidden along the way. They carried all of their spoils with them, and they got everybody that was still alive, even the women and the children, and all of the goods back at great odds. We almost wish there was a lot more detail in the narrative. He is victorious, isn't he? We're told in verse 20, only by God's sovereign power. And we find this again and again, whether it's Gideon or whether it's David, whether it's Moses and Joshua, over and over and over and over again. Men go to war trusting in God, in the name of the Lord, with God's blessing upon them. They get through the war. They are, well, overwhelmingly victorious against great odds, because sometimes God shows them exactly what to do and where to. He even uses natural things as well to destroy his enemies and this, that, and the other. And they get to the end of it and they say, it's by God's grace. It's by God's power, by God's strength, it's by God's guidance, it's by God's wisdom that we are right now alive and victorious. And it points us, doesn't it? It points us, I think, to the fact that this week maybe we've not got to go and bear arms, get on a plane and go and fight in Iran or anywhere else, but we have got a fight on our hands, believer, for the rest of the week and for the rest of our lives, haven't we? And as Zechariah tells us, it's not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, God's work is going to get done. Jesus reminded them, he tells them, all authority, all power in heaven and earth is given to me. You've got a great commission to go and fulfill, but you make sure you wait in Jerusalem until you are empowered from on high. And once you have received my spirit, you will receive power when my spirit has come upon you to be witnesses to Judea, Jerusalem, your own city and town, location, community, Judea, the county maybe, Samaria, the country maybe, and to the ends of the earth. There's always going to be problems and there's always going to be opposition. There's always going to be things like this, and we're all tempted as we close this morning to be discouraged. Maybe you're discouraged. Maybe you are bitter. Maybe there are things that make you angry. There are things to complain about. You are anxious about things. Maybe you are apathetic. Maybe you are compromised. Simply put, God is calling his people to be godly, to be humble, to be zealous, to be joyful, to be thankful, to be loving, to be generous, to be self-controlled. And the enemy is going to use all manner of things to steal, kill, and destroy. He roams around, the Bible tells us, like a roaring lion, seeking whom he might devour. And how are you going to overcome? How are you going to be victorious? Abraham had to go at night time, outnumbered, to get back his son. And with God's blessing upon him, not only did he get back, sorry, not his son, his brother, his cousin, or nephew, sorry, Lot. Not only did he get Lot, he got everybody back and all of the goods as well. And he has to acknowledge that he has fought in the strength and the power with the wisdom and the ability of God. And as we've maybe finished a year or finished a week, we're kind of there, aren't we? Really, we finished a week and we're starting a week. We finished a year and we're starting it. Have you fought in the power of God? Have you overcome temptation in the power of God? Have you overcome discouragement? Have you overcome compromise? Have you overcome apathy and lukewarmness? Have you overcome the temptation to grumble and complain, to murmur and criticize? Have you overcome whatever it is in your life, the power and the strength of God? Paul tells us that there'll always be an inner battle. There'll always be a fight inwardly. We must put to death the deeds of the body. You must put to death the flesh. You must put to death all the temptation. You must put to death all of those characteristics, all of those natural tendencies that you have as a fallen human being to not be like Jesus. You've got to put them to death. There's no easy way. You can't be pacifistic. You've got to reach down, as John Owen says, with both hands and rip them out by the roots and continue to do it to the end of your life. You will only be able to bear fruit by the Spirit's power. That's why it's called the fruit of the Spirit. Because you can't produce love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, gentleness, faithfulness, or self-control in your own strength. You can't do it. No matter what your natural tendencies are, you will be fallen. You will stumble in many, many ways. And the only way that you can bear the fruit of the Spirit is by the Spirit's strength. In military language, Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 6, doesn't he, that we must put on all of the armor and even take the offensive sword, which is the Word of God. We've got to go out with the Word of God this year. Got all the youth group. We can invite people in. We can give them leaflets. We can tell the kids to bring other kids. And this, but we've got to do the work. We can't ask the unconverted kids to bring their unconverted friends into a club and hope that they will do so and that will lead to some contact. We've got to do it, haven't we? At work. With the carers that come into your homes. With neighbours. Places where you shop. Giving out leaflets, talking with people, getting to know people, smiling, taking an interest in somebody, remembering their name when they have a name badge so that you can look at them next time you see them. You don't need to look at the name badge, you remember their name and you talk to them. It goes miles and miles because as far as they're concerned, they go to work every day and they're just a number, they're just a machine and nobody cares. And often the ways that their bosses and the companies treat them with the zero-hour contracts and everything else, they are discouraged. And you show some interest, you show a bit of love, you remember their name, and it goes. And then when you give them a piece of literature or something, they are far more likely to read it. We must overcome, the book of Revelation tells us, and we are promised a restored paradise if we overcome. Once again, Peter Cornish, like many others, have passed from this world in the life that is to come. And I do believe that I could sincerely say that Peter Cornish, on his deathbed, would be able to say with the Apostle Paul, I've run the race, fought the good fight, kept the faith. Now's laid up for me a crown of righteousness, not only for me, but for all those who love the Lord Jesus Christ appearing. And in a room this size with this many people in, I know for sure that there are people here this morning who are not ready to die. And if this week was your last week, you would not be able to say with your dying breath, I've fought the good fight, I've kept the faith, I've run the race. And this passage reminds us that we live in a world where there is battles. There's battles inwardly within me and within each and every one of you, believer. And you've got to fight. And there's a great commission to fulfill, and it won't be done in a pacifistic, non-active way. It has to be done. Violent men will take the kingdom violently, Jesus even tells us. It has to be done in love, but it has to be done with activity and effort and weapons of truth and love, generosity, self-control and kindness, and taking up our cross daily and following him. And unbeliever, the last words for you this morning are, would you leave this place as an enemy of God? All the people or things that you would be enemies with, he is the last one you want to be enemies with. And Jesus says that he is the best friend and the friend of sinners for all the rebels who would bow and kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish on the way. Real history that really confirms the Bible, isn't it? It's real violence that would challenge our apathetic, pacifistic thinking, maybe. And it's a real war that causes us to really depend upon God and fight this week and this coming year in his strength and for his glory. Let's close.